chasing rabbits, and you know you're going to fall. Tell 'em a hookah smoking caterpillar has given you the call. Call Alice when she was just small.
Why don't we just jump into Alice? I think now. Your epic piece took me quite a while to make my way through it. There's so much to absorb.
4 or 5 years to do, you know.
How long?
About 4 or 5 years.
Now, what drew you to Alice in Sunderland? Other than it being your home. I guess that is a factor. Your home.
Well, that was it, really. I mean, for about 20 years. I mentioned this underground comic I did a while ago, you know, which is homage to Alice. And really since then, I've been wanting to do something, you know, really based on Alice, or Alice and Lewis Carroll. And about 9 years ago, I moved here to Sunderland from the other side of the country. I didn't want to come here. I stayed where I was. But my wife got a job here at the university, and I moved here because I can work anywhere as long as I've got a studio. And I arrived in Sunderland, and not only I really like the place, it's a really nice place, I discovered that Lewis Carroll has all these links to Sunderland, and not just Lewis Carroll, also Alice Liddell's family. You know, Alice Liddell is supposed muse for the Alice character. They have all these local links. Her father grew up here. Carol used to come here to visit his cousins and everything. So I thought, this is it, this is my way in to doing something. And what I found myself actually doing in the end was doing a big sort of meditation on stories and storytelling, which is what Alice in Sunderland is. It's all about stories and storytelling. So I had to tell the story of Sunderland, the place where it's set, as part of the story. I had to tell the history of the place, which is a bit like history of Britain in microcosm. It just required a hell of a lot of research. More research than anything else. And the whole thing is not one story, it's just dozens and dozens of stories all sort of tied together.
Well, that's the really interesting part is, yeah, it's so many stories, so many storytelling techniques used too, and art styles. Like, it just seems like it's such an exercise for yourself to really, like, kind of push.
Yeah.
As a storyteller?
Yeah, well, I'm always trying to make things interesting for myself. Like I said, I'm never interested in doing the same thing again, twice. But as I said, the structure was one of the hardest things. I worked for 6 weeks solid on the structure.
Wow.
Making sure that, I mean, you look at the book, you've read it, it seems like it's rambling, it seems like a stream of consciousness. It's not. I mean, if you look at it, everything's foreshadowed. Everything is sort of introduced a little bit before it comes in. Everything weaves together. And, I mean, to do that over 320 pages with all these dozens of stories was really bloody hard work. And it's amazing because, yeah, I read some reviews. I've read a couple of reviews of it. And they said, oh, this is good. But, he, you know, he obviously, you know, sort of making things up as he went along. You know? No, it's the structure is tight as a drum on that book, and it took me a long time.
Well, just it doesn't seem like the amount of work that goes into it. It doesn't seem like you could just make things up on the spot. It's just so much thrown in. Now, how did it start expanding for you as the concept, going from just being looking at Alice and Lewis Carroll and going into the whole area?
It didn't really expand. I mean, I think that was my original idea to do that. And if anything, I've had to actually trim. I had to leave a lot out. I thought what I'm going to do this week, I'm going to tell stories. I'm going to tell one of the stories I'm going to tell is Lewis Carroll, the story of Lewis Carroll and Alice Liddell. So I started from the birth of Lewis Carroll, that bit, and I go up to the death of Alice Liddell in 1930. And I knew I had to tell the story of Sunderland, its history, and its most important legends, stories, which are pretty amazing, really. I mean, the Venerable Bede, as I said, you know, the father of British history, the father of British literature, you know, he was from Sunderland, he lived in Sunderland. The legend of Lambton Worm, which is the biggest self-contained story in the whole book, 18 pages, is the most sort of original and fully formed dragon legend in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these stories where I knew I had to get all these in.
Sorry, I just came across the drawing of Scott McLeod.
Oh yeah,
he's lost weight.
Yeah, he's lost weight since then, hasn't he? No, I noticed, you know, because I've met Scott a couple of times, and I noticed in understanding comics and everything, he always drew himself a lot slimmer than he was. And when I was writing his section, I emailed him and said, would you like to script your bit? You know, you'd like to script your own words, which, as you'll see in a couple of other parts of the book, I actually co-write a couple of the sections with the people who I'm talking to. Anyway, he ignored me, never got back, he never replied.
Oh.
I thought, bugger it, I'm going to draw him fat. I've actually seen pictures of him since, and he has actually shed a lot of weight, so I thought I was drawing him more realistically.
Well, the funny part is actually right after I read it, Scott was in town, and on the show we got to talk to him a little bit about it and stuff. I think he liked it.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere, and there should be something about his comments on it. I think he quite liked his role as a sage.
The overseer of the idea of what you can do with comics.
Mm. Now, you're obviously, you've been in this comics business for a long time, but you're obviously not intimidated by technology, because Alice in Sunderland, you make great use of computer graphics and manipulation. Was that difficult to learn all that?
Well, no, because I've been tinkering with them for, you know, quite a few years before. Treated as a hobby, really. You know, if somebody had asked me for a cover or an illustration, I'd go, all right, this is a good chance to play around the Photoshop, whatever. So, yeah, I've been gradually learning it. I still am, really. I'm actually colouring all the my new graphic novel I'm working on now, which is called Grandville. I'm actually colouring on computer. I'm trying to make it look different. Different from Alice, anyway.
Well, there's so much you can do with Photoshop. I mean, compare what you've done and then look at someone like Paul Hornsheimer, whose color is, you know, completely different, or Chris Ware, or, you know, whatever superhero crap out there. did I say we focus on alternative comics? We focus on alternative comics. Now, what was the initial draw to the Alice stories as a young man?
I don't know. They had a magic about them. I can't actually remember the first time I read Alice. I can't remember at all. But I can't remember a time when I didn't know Tenniel's illustrations. They always seemed to be in my mind. Even when I was little, I knew them. So I must have spent ages when I was very little looking at the pictures. I mean, they're in there, so they're hardwired in there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're so expressionistic, I guess, if
yeah,
that's the right term.
Actually, if you look at Tenuli, he can be quite wooden, you know. And, I mean, people like Arthur Rackham and Mervyn Peake, it's in a way a lot more interesting than Alice images, but it's his images somehow seem magical to me. I don't know if they... have something about them.
Is that something interesting about an aspect of Alice, is that so many people have different takes? Because, I mean, you look at something like this, I mean, there's the more kid-based ones, or there's, you know, the complete madness of Ralph Steadman's version.
Yeah, I mean, it's a completely different... Like, Ralph Steadman's visceral sort of thing on one end, and, like, the Disney version on the other, you know. I don't know the number, but there's... seems to be dozens of different editions of Alice,
mm-hmm.
with illustrations, different illustrations come out every year, and have been doing since 1907 when the copyright lapsed.
Well, if I had kids, I'd be exposing them to the Steadman version, but I'm horrible that way. Now, some of the research into Alice and stuff, what were some of the interesting things you'd come across in the process?
There were lots of interesting things.
some stuff that really, like, jumped out, like, oh my God!
Well, I mean, one of the things, you know, because in the book, because I'm talking about storytelling, I thought I'd better talk about the medium that I'm actually using to tell these stories in, i.e. comics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I point out, you know, several times in the story, the bones of the storytelling, you know, it starts off, you enter the comic through different stages of doing a comic. You start off with the rough for the page, then the pencils for the page, then the inks for the page, and then you start out to just colour on the fourth one. At one point, you can actually see the script for the page that you're reading. You can actually read the script. Some of the scripts of the page you're reading. So I'm trying to point out these things, but I also tell a sort of mini history of the British comics, because I wanted to talk about the medium I'm telling these stories in. And damned if I didn't find out that the Dowd brothers, who were the people who made Tenniel's plates, you know, they made the plates from the drawings that were printed, used to print his illustrations. Damn it, if they didn't become the first British comic publishers. You know, they got out of engraving, they bought Judy, you know, they rammed the point, like I said,
mm-hmm.
and they published Alice Loper's Half Holiday, you know. Actually, a big revelation when I was researching it was to discover that the guy who had the house built where we're living in, the first guy who lived here, he was a councillor in Sunderland for 25 years, and he was also a member of the port, the River Weir Port Authority, which meant that he would have known, at the time, Carroll's uncle, William Wilcox, the port customs collector, at the time when Carroll used to visit him in the port. He visited him quite often, and he also knew he would have known Hebworth Williamson, who was Alice Biddle's second cousin, who was MP for Sunderland for 15 years. So the first guy to live in this house, would have known people connected with both Carroll and Alice Biddle. That was a big discovery. And that's quite a few more, I think. But, these things, once you start getting into synchronicity, you start attracting them.
Well, one of the things that surprised me the most was this, the fact that the American flag, the Stars and Stripes, were based on the coat of arms of the Duke of Sutherland?
No, of George Washington's family.
George Washington's family.
Yeah, I mean, the village of Washington is like 20 minutes drive away from here. It's in the city of Sutherland. This is where the Washington family, George Washington's family, where the name came from. They took on the name of the village, and you see the coat of arms there. It's still there in the medieval manor house there in stone, and it's a shield with the stars across the top and the stripes across the middle.
Now, is this known at all in the United States?
Well, it must be because...
Or partially
ignored. Jimmy Carter made a pilgrimage there and planted a cherry tree in the grounds when he was president. It must be known. So Washington, the village here, it's the only place in Britain that celebrates 4th of July, you know. You know, they set fireworks off, they have apple pie, they, you know.
The dirty traitors.
Yeah.
Maybe they still consider America the colonies.
Oh.
Probably. Yeah, that was something I discovered on living here. I never knew that.
Now, in the process of doing it, do you ever feel like overwhelmed looking at the volume of work that you're putting into it?
Well, yeah, especially when I was in the middle of doing it. I mean, that bit in the middle of the book where I have this sort of crisis of conscience and I scream at the reader, will I ever get paid for this? I mean, that was genuine.
Yeah.
Even though I had that section actually structured into it, when I came to actually write it, I was that was very heartfelt.
Well, thankfully, Dark Horse...
I mean, I thought, right up to the point when it was published, I was thinking, Jesus, anybody apart from me wants to read it? I've been proved wrong, you know, and it's got great reviews everywhere. It's done very well over here. I mean, the first edition sold out in the first 3 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And it went to reprint, and it's going to reprint again pretty soon. It's going to the third reprint this month, I think.
Is it gonna
it was over here, it's had amazing responses. It's had like half-page reviews in all the national newspapers. I've been on TV, the radio, national radio, the works, you know. It's had a big positive reaction over here.
I'll find stuff I sent to Edmund out of dust. Keep your mouth upon the British government.
How are the people of Sunderland welcoming it?
Oh, they've been going crackers over it. It was in the local bookstores. It's been, like, in the top three bestsellers for the last few months. I had a signing here when it just came out, and we sold 60 copies in 2 hours. I think that's pretty good for a book. But, you know, it's quite thick. It's $27 in America. Over here, I've been in all the local papers for, like, 40 miles around, you know. Local TV, local radio, all this sort of stuff. They're buying multiple copies to give people presents.
I read a review in the Guardian Weekly.
Right.
Very positive.
Yes. I just came back from Australia. I was at the Brisbane Writers Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave this Alison Sunderland talk that I do. I did in Toronto, actually, when I was there. But I gave it there in Brisbane. And afterwards, there's all these Mackems come out of the audience. Mackems, Sunderland people. People who were either born in Sunderland and were expatriate, or people whose families came from Sunderland. And they were all coming up to me afterwards saying, oh yeah, my family comes from there. And they're all buying copies. They've all got great nostalgia for the place.
So Mackems comes from Makes Them?
Yeah, it comes from the time in the mid-19th century when Sunderland was the biggest shipbuilding port in the world. It made more ships than all the shipbuilding ports in Britain put together. And the phrase in the local dialect was, there's those who mack 'em and those who tack 'em. And they made them here.
What was it like researching the book and discovering that your ancestors were complete bastards?
Oh, I've known that for ages. Normans, yeah.
My family is related to Millard Fillmore. You don't get much worse than that. He was an American president before Lincoln, who didn't think slavery was such a bad thing.
Oh. Were they really that much worse than the Vikings? The Normans?
Well, I mean, the Vikings were terrorists. You know, I mean, they used terror as a weapon, you know, to get what they wanted. The thing is, Normans, they actually... They just recreated the whole country. They took everybody's land away. Everybody had to speak French. I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
We're a bilingual country here.
I'm learning French right now.
Everybody was dispossessed, all the landowners, and it was like an occupying power of foreigners who were suddenly in charge of your land. All your old customs and laws were thrown out the window, and what you had instead of your local Saxon thane, a Viking thane, who settled disputes and everything, instead you had a Norman baron in his stone castle and his army who, you know, taxed you to death. It really was a fascist dictatorship, what we call now.
Well, that's they basically imposed feudalism.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, had it in a way, but it was before. It was, yeah, it wasn't feudalism, but it was real loyalty to families, blood ties.
More Germanic.
Yeah, yeah. You're right, Colin.
Colin, our resident comic book aficionado and history nut.
I am a geek of many qualities.
Now, in the process of doing Alison Sunderland, were you pushing yourself artistically in trying new techniques?
Yeah, that was one of the fun bits of it, you know, to do the ghost story in the style of an EC horror comic, or, you know, to do the Moroccan bit in the style of Hergé or whatever, and the Lambton Worm story in like an arts and crafts style. Yeah, that was, it stopped things becoming stale. I could sort of work in different styles throughout the book.
Now, what's this next book you're talking about?
Old Grand, well, before that, I mean, you know, I've got the prose book out.
The lead artist that Colin has his cameos in.
Oh yeah, yeah, Colin's in that. After working on Alice for all this time, 4 or 5 years, I really wanted something that's fun and quick. So I did this in a month. You know, I sat there and wrote it. I had the idea, you know, and I thought, no, this done this. You know, collected together all the sort of stories that. But, you know, the urban legends of the comic business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sort of stories that get told after hours in the pro bar at cons. And I mean, the idea was this was a fun book, a fun read. And I do make the point that, you know, none of these stories is, I'm not claiming that any of them are true, but it is true that they're actually told in the dimensions. And I'm just trying to get a fun book. I mean, it's not Comics Babylon. I'm not trying to be nasty about it.
No, it's not. It's a fun. No one was hurt, I don't think.
I've had a lot of, you know, people email me saying it's the funniest thing they've read for 20 years, and, you know, they peed themselves laughing while they were reading it. That's good news to me.
My favorite is the Spanish award ceremony. Where,
outrageous.
I interviewed Pete and had no idea about this, and
I'd read about it in the Comics Journal years ago.
I'm going to see them this weekend at Stumptown, so I'm going to ask him and Eric about it.
It's totally outrageous. I mean, but it did actually happen.
It's hard to believe, and it's illustrated by Hunt Emerson.
Yeah, I had this idea, you know, rather than do it myself, I'd just do the text. It's about, sort of quite short, but it's about 43,000 words. But I thought, yeah, Huntsman, old mate of mine from the underground days. I still know him, I still see him quite a lot. And I thought, what a great idea to get him to do the illustrations. He'd be ideal, you know.
I'll totally keep that humour vein.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Like surrealist humour. So that came out in June, The Naked Artist.
My other favorite story is the Grant Morrison pooping himself on the plane in his lovely white suit.
Thing is, he must have told that story, because how else would anybody know?
Oh, he says he's told it to everyone.
He did just tell it. He told it to everybody who could listen. I mean, for years he's been telling that story.
It's not something I'd talk about if it happened to me.
Well, I think part of it was during a period in his time where he was experimenting a lot. That was the he got a thwack of cash and went off to India, and he claimed going to go to Kathmandu to be abducted by aliens, and he went to Kathmandu and got abducted by aliens because that's what he wanted to do.
Really? You said that?
It's in this disinformation. They had this lecture series in New York, and he comes on. I don't even realize it was him. It's just like, who's this Scottish guy? That's got to be Grant Morrison. And he goes off, and he's like spewing liquid all over people in the front of the audience. He's just like, and he starts going off and about how he went to Kathmandu to be abducted by aliens, and when he got to Kathmandu, he was abducted by aliens.
Wow.
Disinformation's neat. They're kind of followers of Robert Anton Wilson, that kind of ideology.
Right.
Is there going to be another Naked Artist? I mean, once you have the book out, I'm sure you're hearing a lot more stories.
Well, yes. I have actually started collecting stories for another book, just in case it sells very well. I think you've supplied me with another one, haven't you, Catherine?
Yes. I've got another one that I've been meaning to send you.
Right.
I've got a question about Colin's story in it.
Hey!
The one about the unnamed publicist. I've heard the story before from Colin himself, and of the publicist going off about beer and China White heroin.
Oh, that one, yeah.
I think he knew who you were, Colin. I have a feeling he knew exactly that you did not do drugs, and he was just pulling your buttons.
Well, he knew I was from Vancouver, but I think he was actually perfectly serious.
I'm convinced that he knew that you're a teetotaler.
The same guy, we went to do a convention. Roberta Gregory, myself, and Joe Sacco did a convention in Portugal, and this guy had arrived in Portugal before us to set it up, and as soon as we stepped off the plane, he was telling us where to go in Porto to buy heroin. this is the first thing we needed to know. We hadn't even changed our money yet, but the first thing we needed to know was where to buy the drugs.
Well, you know, But I sent the text to Eric Reynolds, you know, Fantagraphics, to see if they, you know, when I was still looking for a publisher for it. And he sent me an email back, you know, with laugh out loud all over it. Saying he knew what I was talking about. He knew who this publisher was. Even though, you know, in the book I don't actually mention
yeah.
publisher that works or whatever.
No, anyone who knows him would figure it out.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll leave it anonymous at this point.
Yeah. But yeah, I've had that out, and I have a book coming out from NBM pretty soon, next month or two, I think, which is called The Art of Brian Talbot, which is a collection. It's collecting together for the first time all the sort of magazine and book illustrations I've done.
Nice.
Over the years. It's written a small book, 96 pages or something. But it's, you know, it's one of these art books, you know, like, there is some comic work in there. There's no strips, but there's some blobs of panels and things like that. But it's mainly stuff that hasn't been collected together before, these different covers and illustrations and things. And then I have a graphic novel coming out in November from Desperado called Cherubs, which is something different again. I've just written it. It's actually been drawn by Mark Stepford, who's probably Britain's... Do you know his work? He's probably Britain's hottest indie artist.
No, I don't think so.
He's a bit like Evan Dorkin.
Okay.
Bob Fingerman.
A lot of detail.
Yeah, a lot of detail, very stylized. I didn't want to draw it. I wanted somebody else to give it a really cool, you know... But it's basic. Supernatural comedy adventure series about a bunch of cherubs who get put in the frame for the first murder in heaven, and they have to chase the perpetrator down to New York, where he's setting up Lucifer's base on Earth. You know, it's you know, the beginning of the apocalypse, and they get to New York and you find there's all sorts of supernatural underworld, vampires and zombies and werewolves and everything that, you know, beneath the perception of humans. It's just a fun story. It's a very fast-paced story, actually. And the first graphic novel, if we do it all, it's going to be three graphic novel story arcs. But the first one mainly concerns the vampires, so it's a funny sort of irreverent story about cupids on the loose in New York.
After doing the voluminous work of Alison Sunderland, is that kind of something that you're needing? Is that comedic break with the naked artist and the cherub?
Yeah, I like to do different things. It's totally different, you know. And this new graphic novel I'm working on now, well, I've scripted it and I've done about nine pages so far. It's called Granville, or Granville. I don't know how you pronounce it, actually.
Is it?
We talked about Tenniel before. It was actually inspired by the work of Granville, the 19th century French illustrator, who was a big influence on Tenniel. And he used to draw these anthropomorphic characters in contemporary dress, contemporary Victorian dress. And I thought, I've had a book of this work for ages, and I'm just looking through it one day, and I thought, oh, a great idea for a story. So I'm actually doing a funny animal story. It's got these animals in it. It's a steampunk story, you know, so it's retro SF. I've been describing it as Sherlock Holmes meets Sin City, the animals.
And you're doing the artwork?
Yeah, I'm doing everything. Yeah.
Ah.
Retrofuturist.
How do you spell it? How do you spell Granville?
It's Granville.
Ah.
We have the major street in Vancouver. Take off the D, and that's what it's called.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think we've taken up a pretty voluminous amount of your time.
Thanks very much.
But we really appreciate it.
No, it's been fun.
Yeah.
A couple of glasses of wine. My glass of wine topped up halfway through.
There we go. I can't drink during interviews because I usually space out. And I tried doing that once, and it wasn't a pretty sight. I forget things. Colin doesn't drink.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been... I know. I wrote his story in The Naked Artist.
Oh, this one last thing. I understand you're leaving Sunderland?
That's right, yeah.
Oh.
Pretty Well, we've not sold the house yet, but as soon as we sell the house, we're going to be moving, yeah. I mean, for exactly the same reason I moved here in the first place, because my wife's been offered a much better job at Nottingham University, and I think there's a professorship involved, and it's better pay and everything. So, you know, she goes where the work is, and as I said, I can work anywhere.
What does she teach? What does she teach?
Linguistics.
Oh, okay.
Although, I mean, basically feminist linguistics, she specializes in language and gender.
Oh.
But the new job, it doesn't involve any, it's more be teaching, it's like she's running a department.
Oh, okay.
Well, so,
there's a lot of smarty pants in linguistics.
So, can we expect a book on Nottingham?
Well, funnily enough, I've already started watching Robin Hood movies by way of research. No, I've actually bought the a couple of the box sets of the, I don't know if you ever saw the 1950s British Robin Hood TV series.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No.
You know it.
The black and white one, right?
Yeah. I grew up on these.
They used to show it on TV about 15 years ago.
Right.
On
Green.
It was pretty funny.
Yeah, Richard Green as Robin Hood. Well, I mean, it's part of my childhood, so it's amazing watching them again. It's like being transported back to 1950-odd, you know. But the interesting thing about them is, I don't know if you know, but they were actually scripted by exiled American writers who were blacklisted.
Oh, wow.
Who came over to Britain looking for work. And actually, if you, the first couple of series, there's no writers credited on it at all.
Just so
because of these, you know, blacklisted writers. And when you think about it, yeah, it's obviously, you know, Robin Hood, you know, he's an early communist, you know. And there's actually one story in the third series called The Angry Village, it's called. And it's about these villagers getting worked up about basically an allergy of McCarthyism, you know. So there's some interesting stuff there, you know. So we'll see where this leads. Actually, in Nottingham, there's this amazing pub. I was there a couple of weeks ago, two or three weeks ago. And this pub that's actually built on the side of the rock that the castle's built onto. And the rooms actually go back into the rock, the tunnel into the rock.
Oh, that's awesome.
And this pub was built in 1170. It's still there. It's called The Trip to Jerusalem. And it was actually around in the time Robin Hood was supposed to be around.
Yeah.
That's a much shorter pilgrimage.
Yeah, it's a pub.
See, that's the thing. I don't get any pubs. No pubs in Vancouver.
Well, we got pubs.
Really?
Not the same, though.
There's bars instead.
Yeah.
Well, we've got Irish pubs.
It's not the same experience, though.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I digress. Thank you very much, Brian.
Okay, thanks a lot. I've really enjoyed it.
And I hope you have a pleasant evening. I guess
Thank
it's
you.
Getting pretty late there. Thank you.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair. But her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go. But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools if they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Is there life on Mars?
Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow. Now the workers have struck for fame, 'cause Lennon's on sale again. See the mice in their million hordes, from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. Rule Britannia is out of bounds to my mother, my dog and clowns. But the film is a sad thing more, 'cause I wrote it 10 times or more. It's about to be writ again, as I ask you to vote for something.